Yes, so thank you, Damita. Thank you, David, for bringing Damita to us to hear about what you're doing. We're excited to have what you're doing in our own backyard. So more information. She has some flyers. I think there's contact information. David certainly knows how to get in touch with her. So pray with me as I head into the message. Invite your presence here, Jesus, to bless our whole community, including the kids who have to sit through an adult service. I pray there'd be something they'd get out of this, and that we all would come closer to you. Amen. So we do have kids with us in the room, right? Yes, I see them. I need a little help from you to start. What does a donkey say? What does a donkey say? Hee-haw. What does a horse say? Okay. Now, I chose today's message solely with you in mind. I'll tell you about why I regretted that in a little bit. But I chose today's message because it has in the middle of it one of two places in the Bible where this happens. So you can play the clip.
When I was a little boy, I wanted a pony. Of course, it's been a long time since I was a little boy.
It's been a long time since I was a pony.
Did you say that? Oh, how could you?
Did you say it?
I didn't hear it. How could I? But I did. Oh, this is impossible. I don't believe it. Now, while I'm looking right at you, say something.
Like what?
Anything.
How now, brown cow?
So frustrated.
So you can bring that down. So, animals play a prominent role in a lot of what goes on in the Bible story. They're very central to the beginning when they come into being. They inhabit the ark as it floats on the flood. When there's a prophet who's running away from the task of God, God sends a whale to swallow him and spit him up on the beach of the right destination. Jesus uses fish to help him catch humans. But there are only two places in the Bible where animals actually speak. The first is, of course, the serpent tempting Adam and Eve. And the second happens in our story. So I said, well, we've got kids in the room, let's go for it and see what happens. I found, however, as I went deeper into the story that I'm going to bring to you this morning, that it only went from strange to stranger. You can show the next slide. By the time we get to the end of our story, we will have started with a mule. We will then encounter the angel of the Lord with a flaming sword who becomes, in this story, Satan. We will find a unicorn and a mythical beast called the aurochs, which is supposedly a huge towering predecessor to what we know as cattle. In addition, we will find a spiritual seer who becomes blind. And we will encounter, perhaps most troublingly, the blessing of God on a people engaged in what we would call imperialism, colonialist expansion. So I found myself, I think it was Wednesday night, thinking, what have I done? It was past the point of no return because I had passed on the title and the scripture to the people who do our bulletin. So I couldn't turn back. But I did what I typically do in these instances. I said, I actually do believe that this text has something valuable for us. So I sat in it. I pressed through. I prayed. I said, God, please help me see the goodness that you have in here for me and for us. And I think, at least for me, it did end up turning out okay. So I'm going to share with you this morning what comes from this story, the goodness that I think God has in it for us, much of which centers around the almost magical power of speaking words of blessing, the degree to which God is committed to this as a way of you and I communicating with each other. So the story itself starts out like this. This is from the Old Testament, the book in the Old Testament called Numbers, chapter 22. It says this. The Israelites set out and camped in the plains of Moab across the Jordan from Jericho. Now Balak, son of Zippor, saw all that Israel had done to the Amorites. Balak was in great dread of the people because they were so numerous. Balak was overcome with fear of the people of Israel. And Balak said to the elders of Midian, this horde will now lick up all that is around us as an ox licks up the grass of the field. Now Balak, son of Zippor, was king of Moab at that time. He sent messengers to Balaam, son of Beor, at Pethor to summon him, saying, "A people has come out of Egypt. They have spread over the face of the earth, and they have settled next to me. Come now, curse this people for me, since they are stronger than I. Perhaps I shall be able to defeat them and drive them from the land, for I know that whomever you bless is blessed, and whomever you curse is cursed." So Balak is a king of his people, the people of Moab. Next to him is the country of Midian. And at their feet have emerged, have in a sense come out of nowhere, this group of individuals who he seems to be very afraid of. Right? You hear kind of the language of panic, of anxiety in his talk. Perhaps of exaggeration. It's this incredible horde. They're going to destroy us like an ox eats the grass. Oh, we need help. And this, of course, is the Israelites. This nation of emancipated slaves who have emerged from captivity in Egypt, been planted in the desert for a couple of years by God as he teaches them a new way of life, from whence they, for a variety of reasons, take a circuitous route that lasts about 40 years to the point that they're now at, where we encounter them in this story. They are on a journey to a glorious destination called the Promised Land. The problem is that on the way, they have to pass through the backyards of other people. And most of the folks, as this horde, you know, it's like after the aftermath of some great party, celebration event. There's a lot of clutter. They take up resources. They jostle folks on their way through. So most of the folks who own the land, who run the countries through which this ragtag band of nomads has to pass, are not thrilled to accommodate them. They typically say no, or, well, we'd rather not, and they put up resistance. The thing for the Israelites is they have God to help them. And God does seem to act on their behalf. So when they come to the base of the land of Moab and Midian, Balak is terrified. He says, oh, they're going to win. They've got this really powerful help. So he sends away for help of his own. If they have a spiritual champion, I will get one of my own. And he sends for this guy named Balaam. Right? Balaam would have been apparently a pretty well-known, powerful, spiritual mercenary. He had the ability to do things on your behalf, to bless, to curse, and if you paid him enough and sent powerful enough people, he'd come and do what you wanted him to do. right? So Balak sends emissaries, you know, probably relatively high-ranking officials, a small group of them, with some treasure, and communicates to Balaam, I would like you to come and curse the people at the foot of my mountains so that I am more likely to be successful at defeating them. So we'll get back to the text in a minute. But what unfolds from this, so Balaam says, well, I'm interested. You know, I'm in. Looks like your money is good. But he says, but first I got to check with my sources if this is okay. So he goes to bed that night, and God comes to him. He seems to have an inside track on communicating with God. God comes to him and says, hey, who are the people who are visiting you? Balaam explains the situation to God. Well, these are messengers from this kingdom, from Moab, and they're feeling a sense of threat, and they want me to come and curse some folks. What do you think? And God says, sorry. I have chosen to bless these people and not curse them, so you can't either. Balaam goes back to the messengers and says, yeah, I can't come with you because their God is blessing them and not cursing, and he won't let me curse them either, so sorry. The messengers go back to Balak to give him the information, and he responds by sending more important people with more money back to Balaam. Like, he's not deterred. He didn't get the message. So you're saying there's a chance, he's saying. Balaam receives this higher level group of messengers and sees more money and says, yeah, I just don't think that's going to work. This isn't a matter of how much money or how important you are, but I'll check. Goes to bed that night. God comes and speaks to him and says, what's up? He explains the situation, and God says, here's the thing. You can go with them. But he makes it very clear. You have to do only what I tell you to do. On that condition, you can go back with them. Balaam says, yippee! Hops on his mule, packs his bags, and heads off with his servants and this group of emissaries, of ambassadors, of high-ranking officials from King Balak. That's where we rejoin our text. It says, God's anger was kindled because Balaam was going, and the angel of the Lord took his stand in the road as a Satan. Now Balaam was riding on the donkey, and his two servants were with him, and the other emissaries. The donkey saw the angel of the Lord standing in the road with a drawn sword in his hand, so the donkey turned off the road and went into the field. All right, so a couple of things that are worthy of comment here. The first is, I kid you not, in one sentence, God says go, and then the next thing you know, as Balaam is going, God is getting angry, so angry that he puts an angel of the Lord with a flaming sword in front of him. You know, and you think, God, what is up with you, right? Either God is just capriciously toying with us. Yes, you may eat that cookie. That was the last one! Or there's something going on within Balaam that we have not been privy to yet, but that will become clear as the story unfolds. If you remember, the one command of God to Balaam was, do only what I tell you to do. And that seems to center around another thing that will be central to this whole story, and that is bless. Bless, 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 bless. No cursing, only blessing. Right, but Balaam has got all sorts of things going on. All the information he has about this people who aren't that far away from him is that they're a marauding horde. Not the kind of people you would really want to bless. Maybe he feels that threat is going to come towards him next. He's also got the whole cash mercenary thing going on, right? You know, sure, God, I'll do what you want me to do, except when you're not looking. Because I might be able to get some money out of this. Whatever is going on for Balaam, he is so absorbed in his own thoughts and plans and intentions and wonderings, the story tells us that even though he is a spiritual seer, like this is what he does for his life's work, when the angel of God appears in the path in front with a drawn sword, he can't see it. Right? And the bafflingness of this is highlighted by the fact that his mule can. Balaam, the spiritual seer, cannot perceive God in front of him. He is so absorbed in his own thoughts, ideas, plans, intentions, that he cannot see what a mule can see. So the mule takes evasive action, right? He goes off the road and into the field. I'm not going in that direction. The other interesting thing, so the angel of God, and again, this tells us how meaningful, whatever it is that Balaam intends to do, God is really, 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 really opposed to it because he becomes a Satan. It's helpful to keep in mind that the concept of Satan as a being, as an entity, as an individual, like with a tail and a red suit and horns, didn't come into being until the Christian thought did that in the Middle Ages. In the time of this story, even in the time of Jesus, Satan was just a word for the embodiment of an adversary, an obstacle. Right? If you were going somewhere, you had a destination you wanted to arrive at, and something stood in your way to prevent that, that thing was a Satan. So in this story, for example, the people of Moab are a Satan to the Israelites as they're going on their journey. We get to the New Testament when Jesus is going on his journey to Jerusalem that he's told his friends about, and he says it's going to end badly. Peter pulls him off to the side and says, "No, you're not." Jesus says, "Get behind me, get out of my way, Satan." Right? So here, the angel of God is so opposed to whatever it is Balaam is doing that he inhabits the identity of a Satan. The only other time that happens is after Adam and Eve have been expelled, and the angel of the Lord with a flaming sword blocks their way back in to the garden. So the story continues. The donkey goes off into the field, and Balaam struck the donkey to turn it back onto the road. Then the angel of the Lord stood in a narrow path between the vineyards with a wall on either side. When the donkey saw the angel of the Lord, it scraped against the wall and scraped Balaam's foot against the wall, so he struck it again. Then the angel of the Lord went ahead and stood in a narrow place where there was no way to turn either to the right or to the left. When the donkey saw the angel of the Lord, it lay down under Balaam, and Balaam's anger was kindled, and he struck the donkey with his staff. Let me get to the best part of the story. Then the Lord opened the mouth of the donkey, and it said to Balaam, "What have I done to you that you have struck me these three times?" Balaam said to the donkey, "Because you have made a fool of me. I wish I had a sword in my hand. I would kill you right now." But the donkey said to Balaam, "Am I not your donkey, which you have ridden all your life to this day? Have I been in the habit of treating you this way?" And Balaam said, "No." So you'll notice that Balaam reacts differently to his donkey speaking than Wilbur did to Mr. Ed speaking, right? Balaam doesn't say, "Wait, what? What did you just, you're talking?" He is so caught up, at least in the way the story is presented to us, in his own self-absorbed thoughts that he just runs off with this like it's normal. Like, "Well, I'm glad we can finally talk about what's going on. I am so mad at you." And the donkey is amazing, right? It's like the most eloquent being. "Have I been in the habit of treating you this way?" No. And you can begin, at least I can, to have a sense of where this might speak to me. I certainly don't always run parallel to God and his thoughts, his intentions, his desire for how I would behave and speak in the world. I have my own agendas, my own desire for the way things would go. And I become consumed by that to the degree that I stop being able to see God altogether. And one thing this story seems to be saying, at least to Balaam and through him to us, is that'll happen to you. But one source of help might be those around you who are close to you, who you know, who you trust. Because they will communicate to you, you're off the mark here. You're saying things and doing things differently than I think you should be saying and doing. And our reaction to that, too, is almost always to try to beat them into our way of thinking and being. But the story is saying, oh, if you can pay attention to those who trust you when they start calling you out, things might go better for you. The story goes on, and Balaam has his own conversion experience where God finally works on him. It says, then the Lord opened the eyes of Balaam, and he saw the angel of the Lord standing in the road with a sword drawn in his hand, and he bowed down, falling on his face. The angel of the Lord said to him, why have you struck your donkey these three times? I have come out as a Satan. Again, you will read it in most translations as an adversary. Because your way is perverse before me. The donkey saw me and turned away from me these three times. If it had not turned away from me, surely just now I would have killed you and let it live. Then Balaam said to the angel of the Lord, I have sinned, for I did not know that you were standing in the road to oppose me. Now, therefore, if it is displeasing to you, I will return home. Please let me go. Sorry. The angel of the Lord said to Balaam, go with the men, but speak only what I tell you to speak. So Balaam went on with the officials of Balak. So again, it seems like something in the intentions of Balaam veered from what God would have him do. And beyond just becoming, really self-absorbed and missing all the cues and becoming spiritually blind, I think there's something, and it becomes clear, that has to do with this notion of blessing versus cursing. David announced that we have an upcoming marriage seminar based on information from the Gottman Institute. We attended the one that our church did last fall, and I'm on their email list. The most recent email that I got said something like this. A sign of a healthy marriage and a thing you can do if you want to produce a healthier union is to have affirmations far outnumber critiques. And what I love about the Gottman Institute is they take these principles and they boil them down into really quantifiable, concrete tasks. So it said specifically, affirmations should outnumber critiques, you towards your spouse, by a ratio of at least 5-1, most desirably 20-1. Right? So nice things you say versus critical things, or in the language of our text today, blessings versus curses. And if you're experiencing discord in your relationship or things aren't going that well, you could aspire to this ratio of affirmations versus critiques, blessings versus curses. I read that and I thought, wow. That's a high number. My experience of self-examination as I read this, I realized that there are probably some days where I would come up wanting. And so I thought, well, I'm just going to try this, right? I'm just, like, I read it, and 10 minutes later, I just came out, simple things. Thanks for helping clean up the kitchen. Thanks for all you do. Just words of affirmation, blessing, positivity, niceness. And it was remarkable. So I love my wife. She has a million incredible, wonderful qualities. I would do well to say them more. What I found as I said these things to her is that, first of all, she felt good, right? It's nice to be the object of affirmations, of statements of blessing and positivity. But I also became aware, it's like, as I'm saying something to her of blessing or positivity or affirmation, it's a true thing. I'm not making it up. I'm not doing something just to produce a good effect, right? I'm stating things about her that are positive, good, right, that are true. But I become captivated by their truthfulness. The truthfulness of them deepens and expands and leads to other truths of affirmation and positivity. And so as I do it, it's the self-reinforcing thing where I am more deeply converted to the wonderfulness and blessedness of my wife. And it's a remarkable phenomenon. And I think this principle, I think God is after something where he's highlighting this particularly in settings where there is some degree, for some reason, of power disparity. So we have, it's again a remarkable story because we are taken, Balaam is taken and us with him by Balak, not once, not twice, not three times, but four times up to the top of a hill where Balak has Balaam look down on the Israelites below and says, "Would you please curse them?" He begs, he pleads, he cajoles, he offers sacrifices. But Balaam, by this point, is pretty convinced, no, I can't do that. You know, there is the flaming sword thing, and yeah, it's just like, I got to stay true to the task here. But you feel him as he gives these pronouncements, wrestling with it. So this is from number one. Balak, the king of Moab, brings me from Aram, from the eastern hills, saying, "Curse, curse Jacob for me. Come and denounce Israel." How am I to curse those whom God has not cursed? How am I to denounce those whom the Almighty has not denounced? From the top of the rocks I see them. From the hills I behold them. And listen to what he sees. Yes, a people that dwells alone and that does not consider itself one of the nations. So the information from Balak is that this is a marauding horde, super powerful, going to destroy everything in its path. Right? And God has blessed them. This is the text of empire, of colonialization, of imperialization, of expansion. Right? God blessing a select people. This is the scandal of the Old Testament. God has chosen one people from all others on the face of the earth to be his favorite. And he's going to bless them in the face of all others. But what does Balaam see when he channels the vision of God? He sees a group of emancipated slaves, a group of immigrants trying to have standing in the world, but being resisted at every step. He sees a group of people without an identity, without land, without a place of safety, without a place from which to develop an identity. He sees that in these people at his feet. He says, I think God wants to bless them. And then it becomes God not doing some crazy, capricious thing that we can't understand. It is God blessing the emancipated, God blessing the immigrant, God blessing the one that intrudes on your space and mine. And it no wonder then that it becomes for Balak this story of, oh, they're going to mess up everything. No, we can't make room for them as they pass through. And you hear Balaam wrestling with it. Listen to what happens by oracle number three. He begins it this way. Balaam lifted up his eyes, and he saw Israel abiding in their tents according to their tribes. And the Spirit of God came upon him, and he took up his pronouncement. And he said, Balaam, the son of Beor, hath said, the man whose eyes are open hath said, he hath said, which heard the words of God, which saw the vision of the Almighty, falling into a trance, but having his eyes open. So do you hear? This is his new sense of identity, right? This is not Balaam saying, I'm a pretty awesome guy. You'd do well to pay me a lot of money because I have powerful pronouncements. This is Balaam saying, I am a fallen person who was blind, but whose eyes were opened by God to see things as they really are. That is my identity now. And from that, I see things in a way I didn't see before. I perceive what's actually going on. And listen to the words that flow. This is towards Israel. How lovely are your tents, Jacob, your encampments, Israel. They spread out like valleys, like gardens by the riverside, like succulent aloes planted by the Almighty, like cedar trees next to the water. Water will flow from their branches. Their seed will have water aplenty. Their king will be higher than all others, their kingdom lifted high. God who brought them out of Egypt gives them the strength of a unicorn. I'm not making that up. It's in the King James Bible. There apparently was this word that referred to a mythical creature that the translators didn't quite understand. It turns out to probably be something called an aurochs, which is a now extinct predecessor of cattle, but this was a huge beast, 6 feet tall, 3,000 pounds long, horns ferocious. But what you hear is Balaam waxing eloquent about the awesomeness of these people below him. He now sees and says, and it flows from him, words of blessing. He's no longer overwrought or tied up in knots about it. In his fourth oracle, he introduces himself in exactly the same way, saying only this in addition: I now have the knowledge of God. Like, in this whole story, the only being that's changed is Balaam. He has inhabited the edict of God to bless and not curse, right? And don't you think this should just be a command for all human relating, right? In all human relationships, let's go for at least a 5-to-1 ratio, 20-to-1 if you're really good. But especially in relationships where there is a power imbalance. So personally, parent to child, teacher to student, boss to employee, older to younger, healthy to weakened, but also in the world, right? Landed to immigrant, free to emancipated, all domains of relating. Bless, 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 God says. And this is the invitation for you and me, I think, that if we inhabit this, you and I will be transformed. We will see what God sees, hear what he hears, know what he knows, and do what he did here. So let's stand. I invite the band to come forward. We turn now to First Communion. This is a practice where we celebrate God's blessing of us through Jesus. We partake of the bread and the cup of juice, which represents his body and blood shed in blessing for us. If you want to connect with Jesus more deeply in this way, with the blessing of God coming to you and to me, you're all welcome to join in this with us. You can come by yourself, friends, family, share with each other. We also have people out in the foyer who'd be happy to pray with you to bless you. If you came with a need for prayer or you want to enter more deeply into anything that came out of this story this morning. And from there, we'll continue on in musical worship together. So let me pray to bless you. We come to you, God, and we hear your words of blessing for us, your invitation to inhabit blessing and not cursing as a way of being towards others in the world around us, and particularly in those places where we have power, where we have the ability to speak words that produce real effects on the people around us. Would you help us do this and enter into seeing what you see, hearing what you hear, and knowing what you know? Amen. So come for communion as you're ready.